You found Wells Tech, the show about technology and ministry. This is episode 331 for Tuesday, March 4th, 2014. We're going to be talking about mobile apps, and specifically mobile apps that are hosted on the web. They're very easy to create. In fact, you probably could create one in less than 2 hours. We'll talk about how we do that. Sally happens to be in Mississippi, but that won't stop us from our tips and picks and community feedback through the wonders of technology. She's going to join me and share all that stuff as she always does. Stay tuned for that and community feedback, and join the conversation. Thanks for being here. This is Wells Tech, a show that explores the intersection of technology and ministry. Wells Tech is a part of the Streams Media Network, sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. We are live with Wells Tech. This is Martin Spriggs, and Wells Tech is a show about technology and ministry and where those two meet. Thanks for joining us, everybody. You may have noticed that by about this point in the show, I've introduced my co-host, Sally Draper, except Sally is on vacation, although she's going to join us in a little bit when we get to our tips and picks and community feedback section, if she didn't want to miss that. So through the magic of pre-recorded Google Hangouts, we can bring her in and we can have that conversation. So you've got just me for the topic today, and so happy that you joined us. As always, we record whoever's here at Tuesday afternoon, 4 o'clock Central. So if you're tuning in live, you can join the conversation by asking a question. There's a link there. If you just click on the video itself, and it will pop up a box, and there you can ask a question, and I will do my best to answer those questions. So trying to make this as interactive as possible. The topic for the day is kind of a one-man show. Over the weekend, on Sunday evening, I was privileged to attend a conference that has been a long-running conference, actually. James Monkey, the technology director over at Luther High in Onalaska, made me aware of this when I was out. I think I was out in New Ulm with our UnTech, our UnConference, our Wells Tech UnConference. He said, hey, have you heard about our Brainstorm conference, which is held in the Dells each year? I think they've been doing it for 15 years now. Basically, it's billed as a show or a conference for tech directors or for ed techs by ed tech, so by ed techers. And so I went out there, and I was out there Sunday, and it was kind of amazing to see all those people there together for one purpose and a very well-run conference. I was only able to stay there through, you know, like Saturday or for till Monday afternoon, but I was able to present a topic on Sunday afternoon on building a mobile web app. That's kind of what I do nights and weekends these days with the Wells mobile app, and thought I would share my experiences with those tech directors who were interested in kind of learning how really relatively easy it is to build a mobile web app. So I'm going to walk you through that for the first portion of our show today to kind of give you an idea if you're kind of in that spot where you're thinking, well, maybe I need some kind of mobile application, whether it's education specific or for a church, and you didn't quite know where to start, but you knew that you wanted to get more mobile, it's fairly easy to do. So that's what I want to share with you for the next few minutes, and we'll jump into our tips and picks and have the familiar face of and southern drawl of Sally Draper join us. So let me do a little bit of screen sharing here, and I will share with you the presentation that I walked everybody through during the workshop that I presented. It was a two-hour workshop, and I built it as a building a mobile web app in 2 hours. So there's not a lot that you can do in 2 hours, but indeed you can build a web app in just 2 hours. So I started by really asking the question, why a mobile app. Why, especially a simple mobile app? Most of the people there were not mobile app developers, and I'm sure most of our listeners here aren't mobile app developers either. Why would you want to invest the time in building a kind of a relatively simple app? Because that's all that you can do without a lot of serious training and a serious time commitment. And I think there are some use cases for that. There's kind of those single-use applications, those narrow or niche-use applications that, you know, there isn't maybe an application or a program out there that meets your needs, so you want to maybe just build one. Sometimes the need is that it needs to be a cross-platform app, something that you know, somebody can just pull down, whether they're using a tablet or an Android tablet or an iPad or one of the many phones, including Windows phones, whatever. So it needs to work across all those platforms. You can't control how it's going to be viewed. And then, you know, one of the big items is all about cost. Some of the application development costs can be extremely high. So with little or no money, you can build some of these simple mobile apps. And, of course, it gives you the freedom and flexibility. And for a lot of our audience, it's kind of that geek cred. You just like doing geeky things. You like doing things that are fairly easy to kind of push out and get some instant gratification, but you're using some technology tools. There are other options out there, and we've talked about those on the show in the past. App Maker is one that I've tried. Mobile by Conduit. MobinCube is a new one. They all kind of allow you to build an app pretty quickly with drag and drop kinds of tools, but you're kind of locked into their tooling. So if you don't like the way they do it, most of them charge something to get it into the App Store, then you're kind of locked in, and maybe that's not the best approach. But the good news is that you can build a pretty simple mobile app all on your own with some simple HTML and CSS and JavaScript coding. So that's really what the workshop was about. So I did want to talk a little bit about the difference between a web app and a native app. A web app is going to be in the browser. So on your device, you need to open up your browser, whether that's Safari on iOS or an iPhone or iPad, or usually Chrome now on Android devices, and need to go to a website URL. So the good news with that kind of web app is you can use kind of the same tools that you do to build a website. I know many of our listeners and viewers build websites, so you can use a lot of the same tools, the HTML and the CSS kinds of tools that you use on a website, but you just make it more mobile friendly. Another advantage with a web app, of course, is that as soon as you upload the content to the website or upload the new features, it updates immediately. You don't have to wait for something to go through an App Store approval process. There are some negatives, of course, to a web app, and that's that you can't always find it. In fact, you can't find it in an App Store. It doesn't exist in the App Store. They have to know what URL, what website to go to on their phones or tablets. And you can't access all of the native phone features that you can with a native app. So there's just a couple things that you can use on a web app, like GPS, you know, locator kinds of things, but you can't use other sensors like altitude, you know, some of them altitude sensors or vibration sensors, you know, which way you're holding the phone, those kinds of things. Sometimes, you know, you can't access the camera, and there's a few other things that you're just not going to be able to get at with a web app. But with a native app, you do have some of those things, but you do have some compromises that you make. First of all, to build a native app requires some serious programming skills and different programming skills depending on the platform that you're building for, whether that's iOS or Android or Windows Phone. So that's a steep learning curve. A native app also requires app updates. So if you want to get new content into the app or some new functionality, you have to resubmit it to the App Store. Hopefully it gets approved and then pushed out over time so it's not immediate. You do obviously have the advantage in a native app of easily searchability in app stores. So that's what most people are actually used to these days. You may remember when the iPhone first came out, there was no app store. It was all these native web apps. And they figured out that that was not the model that was working for their customer base. Their customer base expected an app store where you could go and search and read descriptions and add stars to apps and share apps, those kinds of things. Another advantage of a native app, of course, is the full access to phone features. There are some simple tools that you'll need to build a web app. Obviously, you need a web browser, you need a text editor, and some basic knowledge of HTML. There are some optional things that you may need in your toolbox if you want to take it to the next level, some good JavaScript understanding. A Google Drive account's helpful for testing because you can push it out. You may not have known that you could push out HTML content like a web page and have it viewable through your Google Drive account. A Yahoo Pipes account, which I'll demonstrate here in a minute, and an Adobe PhoneGap account, which allows you to take your web app and actually make it into a mobile app in a native, a native app that can actually go in a store. That's what the Wells mobile app is. It's created as a web app. If you go to m.wells.net, you'll see it just as it appears in the app stores, in the iOS and the iTunes store and the Android store. That's because I've used a tool called PhoneGap that'll take that web app and make it into a native app. The app that we built in the workshop was a homework app. And so let me give you a little bit of a preview of what that is. So I'm using an emulator, and I've talked about this on the show before, called Ripple. The Ripple emulator basically takes any website. You can see up here in the URL that I'm going to my Google Drive account, and there's a specific index.html page that I put there that I'm bringing up on the page, and I've enabled this Ripple account just with this plugin in Chrome. You need Chrome to run the Ripple account. And then I've set up my devices to say, hey, emulate an iPhone 5. So if you want to see what your website, your church or school website, or this app that you're building, this web app that you're building, looks like on a device, this is a great way to kind of get that look. So you kind of see here that I'm building a web app, and I can see what it looks like on an iPhone. Now I can change this. Let's say I wanted to see what it looks like on an iPad. So open this up in iPad mode. It'll refresh itself, and now I see what it looks like on an iPad. So this is the app that we built. Let me go back to the iPhone. And as I scroll up and down, you can kind of see that with the app look. I mean, if I go change the horizontal orientation, you can see that it changes along with. And so the app basically takes content from the web and brings it into the mobile app. In this case, it's taking school news from an RSS feed and displaying it in this card interface with a read more link. So it's taking the title, taking the content of the RSS feed item and a read more link, which will actually go to the full announcement. And then also here at the top in this menuing system that we've created, we can now go to a subcategory. So what we built here is kind of a homework app. So a teacher could, through the simple use of a blog, enter blog entries, and her class or his class could go use this app, their parents as well, and take a look at what assignments are up for that class. So you can kind of see here that I've drilled down into all assignments for the seventh grade class. And all this is doing is it's pulling a blog feed. So the teacher simply maintains a blog, and the blog title appears here at the top. They give it a tag of history. So here is a blog post that's entitled Watch World War II YouTube Video. The tag in the blog post was history. Here's the content of the post, when it was made. And then I've created a link here for the full assignment. So all this is done on the teacher's end by simply maintaining a blog. And in my mobile app, I've sucked in that information through the RSS feed that's available and presented it here. And I can drill down. Let's say I want to see just the English assignment. So I've made an entry here. and now I can see just the category of English. And this is a simple, I think I use Blogger, which is a free blogging tool, and just set up a sample account and pulled in that information. So I'm not going to go into the code. I did want to show you how that information is made available to the app, though. So with a little bit of JavaScript, I pull this in through something called Yahoo Pipes. And I think I've made this a pick of the week before. Yahoo Pipes allows you to take any information that is accessible on the internet. Usually it's in an RSS feed, but it can be just raw text from a page. It can be a text file, a CSV file. And you build a little pipe, Yahoo calls it, that allows you to take the data and manipulate it. So that's what I've got going on here. So I've taken the URL for the blog post. You can see that here, martinspriggs.blogspot.com. And as I scroll over here, you can see that it's taking the RSS feed/post/default. And if I click on this, down at the bottom here, you'll see what's in that feed. So we've got 9 items. And in those items, you can see how the feed is constructed. And here's the little category with the term math. And this is the information that gets pulled into the app. So you can see that there is something called description, which is where all the content is. So there's a picture that was in the blog post and some text and so on and so forth. So there's actually 9 of these. But in order to kind of filter this down in the app, you'll notice that when I filtered down to, let's say, so I went to all assignments and I've got all the data here. But then when I actually want to filter down, I just say, well, just show me history or just show me math. And that's done with Yahoo Pipes. So if the data isn't exactly the way you want it, you just add a filter. So I would drag a filter component on here and I would say, for category called term, I only want to show those that contain the word English. So once I've done that, I can show you what happens with the output itself. Now it's filtered down to 3. So it's rather a simple process when you use Yahoo Pipes to pull in some data, filter that data, and get down to exactly what you want, which makes the app building process real easy. And again, I won't go into the code. The one last thing I will mention about the workshop, and the workshop wasn't necessarily all about getting data through Yahoo Pipes, but it was about using a tool called Twitter Bootstrap. And Twitter Bootstrap is a CSS framework, a series of files that you can attach to your web page that will actually customize or stylize the content. So it provides all kinds of styling. So when we looked at our mobile app here, we have this little card, rather popular card interface, so that each one of these is its own little card. That's what Twitter Bootstrap does for you. So you have all kinds of tooling that allows you to lay things out in a grid with just a little bit of code. You just add this to your HTML. You can nest columns. You can do all kinds of things with images. For instance, one of the things that it allows you to do, if I show the app here and if I go back to the the home screen of the app, let's go home. We have this little image at the top, but you'll notice that when we go horizontal on our orientation, the image is bigger. So what Bootstrap allows you to do is kind of make those images responsive and more mobile friendly. So you have the ability then to add a little tag. In this case, it's a class called image-responsive, and it makes that image shrink down to the size of the screen. So there's all kinds of those little things here that allow you to create nice-looking form elements, tables. It allows you to have some nice typography. And all this is through what's called Twitter Bootstrap. So that's kind of the content of the workshop, how you can, in a couple hours, using a tool like Twitter Bootstrap and Yahoo Pipes, take content from the web and build an app with a nice navigation system that allows you to organize content and give somebody exactly what you need to make available to them, and with very little effort. I'm not a programmer by trade, but just with a little bit of research and using the tools that are out there, it's very easy to build an app like this. One final thought is, and if you've built an app, which again is not all that difficult, a web app, you can make it into one of those apps that you can submit to a store, the iOS or Google Play Store, just through something called PhoneGap. And if you go to PhoneGap, Adobe, if you search in Google for Adobe PhoneGap, you will have all kinds of options at your disposal where you upload your app in an archive or a zip file. And finally, you allow it to consume the content, and then it spits out a file that you can then upload to a store. So let me switch back here to our video. So that's what I spent a couple hours with the good folks there in the Dells. We stayed at the Kalahari, which I'd never been to before. Great place for a conference. And so we took a little bit of time and walked through the process, and everybody followed along as we went. And you really don't need a lot of experience. And it was a great experience for me to kind of walk people through that. So it was very cool to watch people build a mobile web app, which they didn't think they could do before. So cool stuff. So I think now it is time to bring Sally in and talk about our tips and picks of the week. So let's see if I can get our video started here. Time to move on to our tips of the week. Sally, my tip of the week is a backup-related strategy. It's the 3-2-1 strategy, very simple to remember. 3-2-1, have at least three copies of your data, so that's the three. Store two copies, or store those copies on two different media. So that would be, could be a flash drive, could be hard disk, could be DVD, whatever those media are, two different media. And keep one copy off-site or probably online. So 3-2-1. You want three copies, one on two different kinds of media, and then finally one off-site. So the reason for that is if it's data that is meaningful to you, you want to make sure that regardless of what happens, regardless of the circumstance, it's a basement flood or fire, it doesn't do any good to keep two copies of your data in the same place, for instance. Because something physically, something could go wrong physically. So you need something off-site. And then you obviously want more than one copy always. So the 3-2-1 strategy is the one that I use. So what I have is a copy on a hard drive at home, sitting on my desk at home. I have a copy of that data on a flash drive. So I have a six, most of the data that I care about are mostly pictures. So I have a flash drive with those pictures on them, and then I also back up that hard drive to the cloud. And actually, I'm going to save how I do that for my pick of the week. So my tip of the week is 3-2-1 backup strategy.
That's great stuff, Martin, and an area that I'm always lacking in and feel ashamed of when you bring up backups. I guess my problem with backups is it's like a moving target, so you have to be really disciplined to go through those steps. And if you're, copying it to different media and things, those aren't things that you can just totally automate and have it do it for you. You have to actually pick a point in time and regularly do those kind of backup functions.
Yes, in some strategies, yeah, and the more manual it is, the less likely it is you're gonna want to do it. So that definitely is the challenge. So
for sure,
there are some automated tools. We've talked about those in the past too, at least for cloud backup. And even if you just do the one copy local, one copy cloud, you're probably better off than than just kind of the traditional, you know, external hard drive, you know, the one button backups that kind of the Seagate drives come with, those kinds of drives, mm-hmm. or Western Digital one backups. So, I mean, that's something, but that's really almost like not having it, especially if something bad could happen, electrical strike that would fry all your electronics or some kind of physical damage to the location that you're in.
Sounds like a good strategy, something we should all pay attention to. And obviously, you know, think of it in terms of our work locations and our personal data. You know, I'm blessed to work somewhere where backups are taken care of in the cloud and things like that. We have a strategy for Synod backups, but church and school offices don't have that kind of luxury in place. So you need to be thinking about these things in terms of your church and school data as well.
Yeah, but sometimes they do have those options, and very cheap options. We've talked about using things like Google Drive, or one of my picks a couple of weeks ago was Office 365. So there are places where you could kind of go cloud, where you're letting somebody else deal with all the, you know, the multiple backups, location, availability, all that stuff. So if you kind of think through it, I think there are options if that's really a concern.
Excellent. All right.
What is your tip?
My turn for a tip, and I'm actually going to reveal the ultimate secret on today's Wells Tech podcast.
The ultimate secret.
Yes,
not just
absolutely.
Any old plain secret. This is
the man behind the curtain, you know.
Okay.
Exactly. And this kind of ties to, very kind people saying to me, wow, you know so much, you know, I always learn something, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's wonderful, and I'm happy that I can help people at times when they have questions, but I don't know so much. All I do when people ask me questions is I read the help files. So if there's a particular software or website challenge that they're having, my first location is, direction is going to be to look in the help files, to look for an online forum, ask a question, that kind of thing. So my tip of the week is basically, when in doubt, read the help, because most of the time you can find the answers you're looking for, and they all have great search capabilities, so you can put in, you know, a little short text string and kind of come up with a selection of answers, and the help can typically solve most of the problems that are out there. I'm struggling right now with an issue with MindMeister, a cloud-based mind mapping service, and I looked through their help and I didn't find the answer I was specifically looking for, so I wrote them a question, and now I'm conversing with their tech support to get an answer. So it's not like I know all this stuff or I have all the answers, but I just know the right place to look, and that's in the help files.
Sometimes it just takes a little diligence. Sometimes, and this is where, you know, the likes of Google and Bing really come in handy, if you can kind of master the art of search and entering the right combination of search terms, there are usually forums and discussions out there beyond just the help documentation that'll kind of zero in on your problem, or you'll at least find other people struggling with the same problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the real helpful tools there is to try and limit the search to maybe the last 6 months or something more recent. So you're not looking at this problem that was kind of talked about in 2008, because you're having this problem probably with the latest version of a piece of software. So you want to kind of narrow it down. But sometimes what you're going to find is that there is no solution to your problem right now, that they're working on it, it's a known bug or whatever. So that is a good stewardship tip. So you're not just, you know, continually churning, trying to figure out this problem when there is no solution that exists. So sometimes the answer is, well, it can't be fixed right now. Just wait and keep an eye on it.
And the good news is, if you tap into that kind of thread of conversation, there may be workarounds or alternates,
right,
that people suggest. So
right.
Just spending the time and the diligence, like you said, Martin, to do the research, to look through help, to tap into those online forums, often pays off, and you learn stuff in the process. So
yeah. Good tips this week. Let's move on to our picks section, our picks of the week. Sally, what's up?
Well, you aren't going to believe this pick of the week. I think it's probably as anti-tech as they go. But tying in even to our conversation about paper versus digital, I have come full circle, Martin, and yesterday I received in the mail my very own Erin Condren Life Planner. This would be a paper-based time management solution. And I got it from the erincondren.com website. Let me show you a quick look at this.
Should I know that name?
Erin Condren is just a designer who's kind of very popular in female blogging circles. That's how I learned about it. So maybe your wife should know that name. I don't know. But she has a cool style that's really popular, and she has a lot of different products. But I'd say her signature product is this life planner that she calls it.
It's kind of like Vera Bradley colors.
Yeah, she has a lot of variety that you can select from, and you can even upload your own photos to include. So
there's the digital angle. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. So kind of one of the neat things is that you get this really nice quality laminated cover, and it incorporates your name or whatever saying you want to put on the front of your planner. So it's very customized. Here's the one I selected. Right down here, but they have, like I said, really hip, cool-looking planner options. Oftentimes when you pick one, there's different color variations that you can select depending on what your style is. So you have fun ordering it online, and then you track it. And I even found a Facebook group, and there's probably actually more than one, that's all about Erin Condren planners and how to decorate them and make them just lovely. So it kind of satisfies your scrapbooking and paper crafting vent as well. So I'm new to Erin Condren, but I used to be a Franklin Planner person. I was all into the Franklin Planner, carried around my leather-bound planner for many years, and lived by the paper. And then I went digital, and I thought, you know, the two can't live together. I'm going to go digital. I'm going to have it all in the palm of my hand and up to date at all times. But you just don't get that full planner experience with a digital small screen. I want to touch the paper. I like playing with paper, and now I have my own planner to do it in. So I guess time will tell whether I truly adopt Erin Condren's Life Planner and make it part of my everyday life. I'm thinking it's kind of my personal planner. I probably could show. It does have my name on the front cover.
Oh, cool.
In a lovely font. So so I'm excited about it.
The way my wife justifies some of these things is it's an accessory. It's just kind of a part of the package. So if everything were on your phone, what fun would there be in that? So
that's right. And, you know, if there's an app developer out there, I guess that's the theme of our show today, but maybe you need to have a girly calendar planner in app format. I'm thinking Erin Condren needs one of those, but she doesn't have it available yet. So there's a market there for it, because girls like that kind of bling in their planners. And I'm not getting that with my Outlook or Google calendars, not to that extent. So
I'll cut you some slack here, because you're digital in many other ways.
But there you go. So I'll let you know how it goes.
Don't go too far. We'll have to look for another co-host.
No, we aren't going there.
All right. My pick of the week is totally digital and related to my tip of the week, and that is a tool that allows you to have cheap or store cheap. It provides cheap digital storage. So my pick of the week, let me see if I can bring it up here, is Amazon S3 services. And Amazon, a lot of us have heard of the S3 services because a lot of people host their websites with it, but there's a particular module of that called Amazon Glacier. And the reason that it's called Glacier is it's extremely low cost but fairly slow. It's secure and durable storage, mostly provided by Amazon for data archiving and backup. So it's not stuff, you're not going to put stuff here that you want instant access to. So it's not a Dropbox or SugarSync or SkyDrive or, you know, Google Drive kind of storage where you can just go grab the file. Sometimes when you make a request to retrieve the data, it takes a couple hours for them to get it available to you. And it's not all that easy to get stuff into it. So it's not something that you're going to kind of set up to sync. It's maybe The way I use it is, I've got these pictures, a bunch of, 60 gigabytes of pictures that I've taken, digital pictures that I've taken over the years. And so I want to make sure that, again, the 3-2-1 strategy, that it's not going to be lost. So I want kind of a really safe place for it, but I want a really cheap safe place for it. And so this is 1 cent per gigabyte per month. So you can do the math. So I just uploaded 60 gigabytes the other day. So that's going to cost me 60 cents per month for as long as I keep that storage. There's really no other cost to it. So they're just charging you for the storage. And that's a lot cheaper than any other solution out there. If you can live with kind of the, it's just going to sit out there in case something bad ever happens. So if you're following the 3-2-1 strategy, you've got the, you've got the two local copies, so that's where you can get at your stuff on a fairly regular basis. But every once in a while, every quarter, maybe you're going to want to say, well, I need to push this out to this cheaper store just so that it's out there in case something bad happens. So it's secure, it's durable, you can put anything out there you want. Some of the problems with some of these things like Dropbox or Drive is you have a file size limitation. So what I've done is I've kind of collected them by year, zipped them up all into one file, and some of these files are like 5 gigabytes. You can't upload that big a file to some of these other services, but with Amazon Glacier, you can. Now, along with that, you need a way to get it up there because Amazon doesn't provide that in a ready, easy, plug-and-play format. But there are a bunch of third-party tools out there that you can do. One of them that I use is the CloudBerry Explorer for Amazon S3. So there's a free client. You just plug in your credentials, and it's kind of like an Explorer version. You just drag and drop your files, and then over time it takes a little time to upload it. So just, for instance, just the Glacier nature of it came through to me. I was trying to upload 60 gigabytes of data over last weekend. It took a day. So you just set it and you forget it, and over the course of 24 hours, 60 gigabytes are now up there, just sitting there, and I'll get a bill. My credit card will be billed every month for 60 cents, basically, because I'm storing 60 gigabytes of data. So that is my pick of the week.
And I can tie that right to my pick of the week, because you need to document when you do this kind of stuff, because a year from now, I may not remember all the nuances of putting things in the Amazon Glacier. And so make sure you document things and set up regular schedules. Maybe put reminders in your life planner or whatever it may be to do your regular
backups. So, Sally, tell me what happens when you lose that life planner. You leave it, in the library or park bench or whatever. Where's that backup?
It's in my brain. Yeah, I got it covered.
Not God has given you a pretty decent backup, but it's not foolproof. But it's,
yeah, I hear you.
It's there. Okay. I'm just teasing.
Of course you are.
Let's move on to our, do we have a Wells.net feature this week?
We do. Let's see if I can share my screen. And what I'm going to share with you is our subscription page on the Wells.net website. You can get there at Wells.net/subscribe. And it's super easy to sign up for all kinds of great content from Wells.net that's regularly updated by my wonderful coworkers there at the Synod office, the Center for Mission and Ministry. You can sign up just by providing your email address, name, and zip code, and get news, devotional content, and then very specific news, things like the Lutheran Schools office puts out a regular newsletter, or the Church Extension Fund regularly updates their loan rates, those kind of things. Multilanguage Publications has a newsletter. Nurse Association has a newsletter. All kinds of great tidbits that you can get from Synod delivered to you on a regular basis. So all of that is at wells.net/subscribe.
Very nice. Great stuff. And we're just a little behind the scenes stuff. We're redoing the entire Synod website this year. So that'll still be definitely a part of it, but you can expect some new and exciting things coming with the new website design and additional content too. So,
Great.
Let's move on to our of interest section. We mentioned this last week, Sally, but we want to make sure everybody's aware of our final web training. This summer, we've got final web training scheduled for, what's the date here?
July 29th through August 1st.
Yep, and we're doing 4 days.
Right.
The first day is very specific to our teachers, so we're building a program all around a kind of a strategy where teachers can build out a classroom website, assignments page, calendaring, notes to parents, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's day one. That's on a Tuesday. And then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Do I have my dates right? Wednesday, Thursday,
yes,
Friday?
You do.
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday are sequential days, beginner, intermediate, and advanced training, just for final web training. Now, teachers could certainly benefit from that, but primarily for webmasters, somebody, you know, man or woman who's maybe responsible for the church or school website that just kind of needs to know how final web's working these days, because they've changed things up quite a bit. Those of you that use Final Web, which is our Synod's web hosting program for websites, they've made some nice changes, but some very different interface, kind of drag and droppy, a little more modern. Things just aren't in the same place that they were before. So, and I think we'll probably talk about the whole streaming package this year too, and maybe the advanced class, because that's a new feature that's been added and I think would be of interest to a lot of congregations.
Definitely, and I'm looking into getting into some discussion of responsive design as well. Final Web actually has new templates that are responsive.
Yeah.
So lots of interesting things going on with Final Web, and the training will actually be held in Milwaukee, or in Waukesha, Wisconsin, I should say, at the Center for Mission and Ministry, which is a big thrill for me. And for any of you who are able to attend, it'll be a wonderful opportunity to see the Synod's new office building. So,
yep. Got a nice big conference room there, big screen. It'd be a nice nice place to spend a day or so to learn about Final Web. Cost and how to sign up, Sally.
Yep, it's $49 a day. If you do the three-day dummies class, it's $129 for those 3 days, a bit of a discount there. And you can find all the details online at bit.ly/FWTrainingInfo, and we will have that link posted for you in the show notes.
Very good. Let's move right along to our community feedback.
Lots of fun stuff to share here. I'm going to start by circling back to our interview last week. That was Tyler Shattuck. Tyler joined us to talk about badges in education, and he wrote us an awesome follow-up email. He said he was thinking about the digital tools that are not suitable for 13 and under learners, but there is this Mozilla badge kit that's coming in early March, hopefully. So we'll follow up and have a link to that when it's released. But because of the age restriction, he didn't want to mention the free WordPress plugin known as Badge OS. So if you're a WordPress user and you want to do some badge type things integrated with your website, you might want to check out Badge OS. It is done by the Credly people. We talked about Credly as being a way to share badges, and that's actually how we shared our Wells Tech badges, was through the website credly.com. Anyway, this Badge OS allows you to easily create badges and set up steps and achievements on your WordPress blog. So I know there's plenty of listeners out there who maybe are appealing to a different audience that doesn't have under 13 and might want to look into this WordPress plugin as well. He also encouraged us to continue exploring gamification as a motivational tool, and specifically pointed us to something, Bartle's taxonomy of player types, and I'll have a link again in the show notes if you want to read more about this concept of gamification and things like that. There's been some serious research in this area into the different kinds of players that are out there, killers, achievers, explorers, and socializers, and how to design things that appeal to those different player types. So again, check that out in the show notes. And thanks again, Tyler, for joining us for that conversation.
Very good. Yeah, absolutely. It was a great it was a great interview.
Definitely. All right, a couple of links from our friend Tom Rosenau, who is a principal over in Pidgeon, Michigan. Let me get back to the top of this blog post. It's called How to Schedule Your Google Forms and Limit Submissions. And boy, was that exciting to read, because adding more and more versatility to Google Forms, which are pretty simple and easy to use out of the box, but maybe you'd like some more advanced features. So basically what this blog post does is it shares a script. So scripts is basically Google's programming language, and you can actually copy and paste the script that's in this blog post, and it will allow you to set the number of responses you'll allow. So a response count variable is in there, and you can set it to whatever you want. And it'll also allow you to open and add open and close dates to your Google form. And another link that I found off of that blog post was to an article called Get Google Forms Data in an Email Message. Google will notify you if you set it up correctly that a new response has been submitted, but they won't send you the data from the Google form through that notification process. But again, with the script that's included in this blog post, you can have it actually send the content from the form to you via email. So I think two really useful things, and maybe a little bit of motivation for me to get out there and play with Google scripting. That's not something that I've gotten into, but a good way to use some of those coding skills that everybody's getting these days from different code organizations.
Yeah, the Google scripts are something I don't have a lot of experience with, but the more and more I hear about it, the more useful I think they can be, and probably useful for, you know, the non-programmer, just to learn a few things. You can do quite a bit, or just use existing scripts.
Tap into these, like these that are being shared on these posts. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. If you want to learn more about coding, Tom also shared an article from the Verge blog, pointing to the fact that code.org is turning the ashes of Flappy Bird into a phoenix of coding education. So those of you that are familiar, code.org is basically exists to help people learn to code. Flappy Bird is a popular game that was recently taken off the market. And so code.org has kind of tapped into that, and you can kind of do something like Scratch programming, where you make your bird do things based on the code that you put over here in the code window. And you have different achievements to work toward. If you go all the way through the whole process, there's 8 different puzzles that you have to solve with your coding skills. Then you actually have a game that you can share with other people. And it all is based on the Flappy Bird kind of motif. So cool stuff. If you're a teacher out there wanting to get your kids excited about coding, perhaps this is the way to get started.
Very nice.
All right. Next up, from Pastor Rob Gunther, he pointed us to Automattic. And apparently Automattic makes your smartphone become one with your vehicle. It's a plug-in, physical plug-in that you put into your car. Goes back to cars manufactured from 1996 and forward. It allows your smartphone to communicate with your car's computer. And it'll do all kinds of special things for you. It'll keep up with your gas mileage and things, and give you tips to get better gas mileage, like perhaps don't accelerate so quickly or whatever it may be. It will track your mileage and things. So if you're someone who turns in mileage for reimbursement or whatever, it'll do all of that kind of thing for you automatically. It'll also send out alerts if you're in any kind of an accident. So all kinds of features with Automattic. The price is $100, like $99.95. There's no annual subscription or anything like that. And one thing Pastor Gunther was particularly excited about is it works with If This Then That, which is kind of an automation toolkit where you can set up recipes. So if Automattic does certain things, it will trigger other responses. As an example, if a trip is completed, Automattic will write it to a Google Docs spreadsheet. So again, you could just kind of keep up with all your trips in a spreadsheet or whatever it may be. Pastor Gunther thought it was probably worth the price and something he was going to look into. So we'll have to circle back with him at some point and get his response.
Well, what he was really trying to do is convince his wife that this is a money-saving, you know, it's like buying stuff on sale. This is going to save
us. It's like buying planners.
That's right.
Paper planners.
It's an investment.
That's right. So
we'll see how that conversation goes.
Good stuff. All right, that's what I got for you for community feedback.
All right, if you would like to offer your own feedback, very easy to do. Go to wellstech.wells.net. That's the website address, and you can leave a note there to one of the show notes, just a comment, or you can send a good old-fashioned email, wellstech@wells.net, and we will try and get that on the show. We also are on Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and Google Plus and all those other social networking kinds of places. Those links are all there on the show notes page as well. We'd love to have you join the conversation. If you can't be here live, the next best thing is to listen in a time-delayed format and send us your thoughts through those channels. So want to let everybody know what we're doing next week. We are finishing our book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains by Nicholas Carr. Those of you that are following along at home, chapters 9 and 10, that's the end. And we're going to see if everything comes together and we have a fairy book, a fairy story, a fairy tale ending, which I don't think we're going to have, but we'll see what Nicholas has in store for us. I've learned a lot, and I think it's challenged the way I look at different things, and hopefully you do too. So tune in next week for that. Sally, if you are listening, I want to tell you how hard it is to do a monologue. So hurry back, and the next show actually will be kind of a challenging one too. I'm going to be out on the West Coast for a conference, and Sally will be back in New Ulm, Minnesota. So we'll still be states and states apart, different time zones apart, so we'll see how that goes. But please try, and if you are available, tune in at 4 o'clock Central next Tuesday to join us in our book discussion. We also want to make everybody aware that we have a music download, as usual, and thanks, many thanks to our Wells musicians who have just been awesome in our request to give away their music. So we've asked each one of them to offer up a couple songs that our listeners and our viewers can download. Kaori Igawa is one of our folks that lives in Japan that works with multi-language publications doing some translation work. I met her when I was over in Japan a year and a half ago or so, and found out that she was a musician, a beautiful voice, and she's agreed to let you all download one of her songs called Call Out to Jesus. So if you go to our show notes page, again, that's wellstech.wells.net, you can download Kaori's song. Thanks, everybody, for listening, watching. Tune in again next week for our book conversation. And you know, keep looking for those ministry resources and listen to reviews and submitting those. We're looking to share that knowledge with everybody. So thank you again for joining us. And Sally, hurry back. Bye-bye.